Hey, it's Jeff. If you're a usual listener to this podcast, and chances are pretty good that you are, then you know my family has welcomed an adorable new addition, and I am on paternity leave. Don't worry, the show and shows will continue. Fortunately for me and you, I've got some great colleagues here at WUNC who are dedicated to keeping you informed about what's happening on the political stage here in North Carolina. And so, for the next few weeks, you'll hear a diverse collection of voices in this podcast feed. Many thanks to NC Modernist's Monday newsletter for their sponsorship of the WUNC Politics Podcast, committed to documenting and preserving 2,400 mid-century modern houses around North Carolina. Subscriptions at ncmodernist.org or by texting modernist to 22828. And thanks to you for listening. Talk to you soon.
This is the Politics Podcast from WUNC. I'm Anita Rao, filling in for Jeff Tabiri to sift through some of what is happening this week in state politics, including proposed changes to our election laws, a big energy bill, and the ever-growing list of questions about our newest federal holiday. Aisha Du from the progressive organization Higher Heights is here, along with Clark Reamer, former chair of the North Carolina Federation of Young Republicans and chief of staff to Republican Representative Jason Sain. Hey there, good to talk with both of you.
Hi, good morning.
This conversation.
Great to talk to you as well.
Thank you. This conversation was recorded Friday morning. So let's start with the proposed changes to North Carolina election laws. The state Senate passed three measures along party lines earlier this week that are all headed to the House. One prohibits state and county officials from accepting money from private sources to run elections. Another would expand online voter registration and create a mobile unit to bring people IDs. And a third would move up the deadline for mailed absentee ballots to Election Day. And I want to start and really zoom in on that third one, Senate Bill 326, dubbed the Election Integrity Act. I want to play a cut of some of the debate from the Senate floor. Here's Democratic State Senator Toby Fitch questioning Republican State Senator Warren Daniel.
Do you believe that then President Donald Trump should have been sworn in as president?
So, Senator Fitch, I'm not really sure that that question is germane to this discussion. He was sworn in January of 2017, appropriately. This bill is not really about any national narrative. It's about what we feel like should be the best practice for the state of North Carolina based on what happened in the 2020 election here in North Carolina. And we agree with the practice of 32 other states that Election Day should be the deadline.
Republican senators behind the bill say these changes are needed to help restore public confidence in elections. You heard Senator Warren Daniel distancing this legislation from a national narrative and the outcome of the 2020 election. Aisha, I want to start with you. Is this kind of measure good for helping North Carolina voters feel confident in the voting process? Does it help restore public confidence in elections?
You know, I think that expanding the process and allowing time, grace, and space for people to get their ballots in and have their votes counted, it's what's really needed for people to have confidence in the process. You know, I think that people had confidence in the process in North Carolina this year, and we need to allow time for people to get their ballots in and count them as they come.
Clark, how about you?
Well, I think people are tired of having an election, going through this process, and then having to wait days or weeks, especially in elections that aren't that close, but just for more ballots to come in to really know the results. And I think that you look at most other states follow the same process that the Senate is proposing here. And I don't think that, you know, I think that is a workable process, a process that will allow everyone to vote. Voters do change their behavior depending on the rules. We'll have voter education. And I think that people want certainty as soon as after Election Day as they can get it, and that this will help with that.
Is it just these absentee mail-in ballots that are causing the delay in counting results, though? There are a lot of other things that the Board of Elections are going through that cause delay, even if there aren't a huge influx of absentee ballot numbers. Isn't that right?
No, that's true. There are other causes of delay, but when we can eliminate some of them and help streamline the process, I think that's a positive thing.
So under current North Carolina law, ballots that are postmarked on Election Day and arrive within 3 days are counted. In 2020, just over 11,000 ballots fit into that category. So if this new bill were to become law, those 11,000 votes wouldn't be counted. Clark, what would you say to those voters who whose ballots wouldn't be counted because they didn't get there for 3 days? They don't really have control over what happens in the USPS mail system. So what do you say to them?
Well, I think the huge assumption here is that a voter wouldn't change their behavior. They're going to know the ballot deadline has changed, and they'll simply mail the ballot in earlier. So to assume that all 11,000 of these people, would still have, they were operating under one set of rules. When you change the rules, they will operate differently.
What do you think about that, Aisha?
I think that people will absolutely try to do the best that they can. And this is the laws that was set up for 2020 gave people space to be able to participate in the process. Of course, it was an adjustment that was made due to COVID. But I think that it is a positive adjustment to allow more space and time for people to participate in the electoral process.
All right, let's move on today to talk about energy. House Republicans introduced wide-ranging energy legislation this week, a 47-page bill, a huge, huge bill, a result of months of closed-door conversations between legislators and a small group of stakeholders, including Duke Energy, representatives from the renewable energy industry, and manufacturers. The bill would retire 5 of the Duke Energy coal-fired electricity plants, 5 of the 8 of them, set requirements for renewable energy as well. Governor Cooper came out publicly with his concerns yesterday morning, issuing a rare formal public statement before the bill even had its first public hearing in the House Thursday afternoon. What do those comments by Governor Cooper signal to you about the potential future of this bill? Clark?
Well, I think like all bills that have just been introduced, this is the beginning. You know, it's been a long process to draft a bill, but it's not the end of the process. It's now entering a public forum. There'll be further discussions. I would be shocked on legislation this sweeping and this complex if there's not further negotiations. I think we have had, I think the governor, I believe in his statement, said he wanted to get to something he can sign. And I believe that the sponsors, Representative Zoka and Representative Arp, want to get to something that can pass into law. So I think we'll see continued negotiations and hopefully a final product that's great for the state as well as the ratepayers across North Carolina.
What would need to be tweaked to have a stronger bipartisan agreement on clean energy? Aisha, I'll let you start with that one.
I think that the regulations need to be tighter as it relates to Duke Energy. And so that's what we're looking for.
Clark?
One thing that's important to look at here is that you have both the manufacturers who represent big consumers of energy who are concerned about the price of the bill and the increased cost of energy, mostly because renewables are a more expensive power source per kilowatt hour. And then you have environmental groups that aren't happy because there's not enough renewable energy. So sometimes you're actually in a pretty good spot when you have both opposing sides that don't love the bill, but for different reasons.
From a process perspective, there have been numerous concerns spoken about this week about how this legislation came together behind closed doors, Duke Energy in the room. I'm curious about whether you all think there needs to be more done to check the power of Duke Energy in these negotiations. Clark?
Well, I've always been somewhat suspect of the claim behind closed doors. I've worked in the legislature for 7 or 8 years now, and I've never seen a bill draft that was drafted publicly. You do your drafting, working with stakeholders, and then you come back and you go through the public part of the process, which is the committee process, which started with a discussion only in the Energy Committee earlier this week. Duke Energy's not the final say in this, and they're not the only say in this. There are going to be many discussions held. Obviously, the governor is going to play a role. Environmental activists are going to play a role. Renewable energy activists and companies are going to play a role. So I'm a little skeptical of those claims. I challenged one other reporter earlier this week, if he could name a single bill that was drafted publicly.
Aisha, what do you say about that one? Is there a process concern with this, or is this just how things happen?
You know, I think that there's always going to be a process concern when people are not at the table during the early stages. I'm glad that there will be an opportunity for people to participate in an open conversation. But it is fair to say that there were not the other advocacy groups and people who represent different aspects of the issue at the initial table.
One of the things that struck me was that there was no mention of climate change at all in the bill. It represents one of the most substantial pieces of energy legislation to come before the General Assembly in years, but it doesn't mention this phrase that is being talked about a lot. I'm curious about your thoughts on the use of this phrase and whether not using it says anything about the state's commitment to a clean energy future. Clark, I'll let you start with that one.
What I think is, especially with some members of the Republican majority, you know, we all want to have a clean environment, but it can cause unnecessary political problems when we're doing what needs to be done. It's expanding renewable energy use by 67% over the next decade. Why put in a possible unnecessary political problem for the more conservative parts of the base to vote for this bill? When you don't need to, and you can get to the goal, which is ultimately to have a clean environment and energy that is both affordable and cleaner than what we have now.
Aisha, are there political consequences to not talking about climate change more openly in a bill like this?
You know, I think that we just need to name it and own it and understand why the work is so important. And climate change is the reason. So it's more than just an idea that's good for us because it reaches some type of undefined goal. We really have to focus on why it's so important.
All right, let's talk about Juneteenth. Congress declared Juneteenth a federal holiday this week. It's a yearly celebration that marks the date that some of the last enslaved people in the Confederacy became free. Federal employees are observing the holiday for the first time today. Wake County, Raleigh, Durham, and Greensboro are also recognizing it as an official holiday for the first time and have closed some municipal offices. Earlier this year, a bipartisan bill was filed in the state Senate to recognize Juneteenth in North Carolina. That bill hasn't been acted upon yet, but I'm curious about what you all think about the political significance of the recognition of Juneteenth in North Carolina. Aisha, I'll let you start with this one.
I think that it's something that needs to happen. I'm glad that it's now happened fully on the federal level and recognized as a full holiday. I can say that our organization, as the political home for Black women, we are definitely observing the holiday. And when you look at all of the things that happened around George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and Ahmaud Arbery last year, around this time when people were marching and looking for recognition, this is not the end of what needs to happen for reconciliation, but I do believe that it is a great step in the right direction.
Clark?
I absolutely agree. It's an important moment. It's a great moment for our country to recognize this and to, you know, really address publicly the sins of the past. You know, we've had a terrible racial history, but we, as President Obama said, summarizing Martin Luther King, the arc of history bends towards justice. And I think that's the discussion that this holiday will allow us to have in a greater public manner. And that is a huge and positive thing for our country.
So while there is this really jubilant push to celebrate Juneteenth, seems like a lot of bipartisan agreement on the celebration, there's really no agreement about how to talk about the history of race in this country in public schools. Aisha, is there any irony for you in that fact?
Absolutely. I think that we have a continuous history of irony, if you will, where I'm, you know, really excited and happy that we get to celebrate this moment. And it goes back to what I said earlier, and that is that we still have a lot of work to do. So this isn't the end of the road, but it is a good moment for us. And we still really need to explore, consider, and develop how we consistently teach the history of our country as it relates to Black people and people of color and all of those who've contributed.
Clark, do you see any irony in that?
Well, I think you have something of a concern over differences in maybe goals. And I think there's a general agreement that we want to discuss the history of race, its problematic issues in our country. I think the concern comes when we discuss about whether the institutions of our country are fundamentally racist or whether, as William Jefferson Clinton said, what's wrong with America can only be fixed with what's right with America, and that our ideas are bigger than the mistakes we have made in the past. So I think you have a lot of differences between discussions that question those ideals versus those that honestly look at our history. And I think that's what we want. We want to teach people how to think and what and how to think about what happened, but not what to think about what happened.
So in the process, kind of relating on that, we did have a decision yesterday by the State Board of Education voted to approve supporting documents to be included with the controversial and politicized new social studies standards that really get to those core questions that you both were talking about of how we talk about the history of marginalized groups, how much we talk about what is at the core foundation, where or if there is systemic racism, how that is addressed in the classroom. We've talked about these standards on the show before, but kind of jumping off the piece of that past conversation, Aisha, do you think it is important in the classroom to address and acknowledge systemic racism and acknowledge that as separate and apart from just saying, yes, there has been racism in the past?
Absolutely. I think that we really have to address systemic racism in the sense that it still affects us today. You know, I work for an organization where we are supporting to get a Black woman back in the Senate, to get a Black woman to be governor, to get a Black woman elected to president of the United States, which of course also means electing a woman. And so when we look at the things that we're still trying to accomplish in this country, and we're definitely working towards equity, we have to address and recognize that there is it's a part of a broader systemic issue.
The phrase systemic racism is not in these new standards. Clark, do you think that that is a net positive?
Well, I think the important thing to remember also is that these standards are not a curriculum. Those are set by local school boards. These are the objectives of things we are looking at overall, but every individual curriculum in communities can reflect their local values and can look at you know, they want a curriculum that adopts the majority of these standards, but nothing is required or forbidden in these standards. So, you know, they're not the end all and be all of how history and civics will be taught in our classrooms. That's ultimately a decision of the local school boards, and they're going to have to make these tough calls in the future.
All right, let's move on to our last topic, vaccines. Right now, if you're a kid in North Carolina, age 12 to 17, you don't need parental consent to get the COVID-19 vaccine. A handful of Republican lawmakers said this week they want to change that and make parental notice and consent a requirement. It's likely that doctors, child advocacy groups, and the governor would push back against the proposal. Clark, a number of other bills on vaccine issues haven't passed this session. Do you think there are political legs for this one?
I doubt it. Again, whenever we're talking about parental consent and medical issues, I think the important thing is to look at what's being done with other medical treatments. And as long as this is being treated on par, then we should continue with that standard and those that movement. You know, I think it's important that everyone be able to make their own informed consent to any medical treatment, but we need to just treat everything as equally as possible.
Aisha, any political legs for this one?
I don't think so. I think it should be on par with what already, you know, takes place for children in medical treatment.
So it's been a few days since North Carolina leaders began offering $1 million in prize money or $126,000 in scholarships for getting the vaccine. The first drawing happens next week. I want to close on just y'all's thoughts on how the state is encouraging vaccination and whether you feel like the state is going far enough to support vaccination efforts in this state. We've stalled at around 50% of the population. Aisha, I'll let you take this one first.
I've been a part of a number of conversations around COVID vaccines, and, you know, there are a number of barriers to access. So I think that they're trying to do their best to actually close the loop between different providers, faith-based organizations, the state and local organizations to canvas, to get out and to let people know what's going on, and also create mobile vaccine spaces. So now I know that we have a goal to make it by July. I'm hopeful that this work will matter and be able to help close that loop. And even after that date, the work will continue. We've just reached the point now where those who can easily access it, who want to access it, now need more help to close the loop so that they can be able to make it to the vaccine sites.
Clark, your thoughts on how the state is supporting vaccination efforts?
Seemingly North Carolina is doing about as well as most other states. I think this is a, we're progressing naturally, and we'll continue to do so. I think we're doing overall a good job. I think sadly that when the FDA briefly pulled the one-shot vaccine, it may have opened some questions in people's mind that maybe didn't need to be there, and that may have, you saw a major dip in vaccination rate almost immediately that we really haven't fully recovered from. So I think this is something of a national issue, and I don't know if North Carolina is doing any better or any worse than most other states.
Aisha Du is the program and political director for the progressive organization Higher Heights. Clark Riemer is chief of staff to the Republican representative Jason Sain. Thanks so much to both of you, and have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for hanging out with us today on the Politics Podcast. While Jeff is on paternity leave, we are still bringing you great content in this feed every Friday. My colleagues at WUNC and I are also busy working on lots of other great projects and podcasts. And I want to tell you about a brand new one that's just added to the lineup. Great Grief features celebrated jazz vocalist Nina Freelon talking about love, loss, and the ultimate shape-shifter known as grief. While you're in that podcast app checking out Great Grief, make sure you're also subscribed to Tested, Dating While Gray, and Embodied so you don't miss a single episode. For Jeff and the rest of the Politics crew, I'm Anita Rao. Thanks so much for hanging out with me, and we'll talk again soon.